goes, and unless I can hear it, I can't seem to fix it well enough to get it Facebook.
So I guess you think it's an open shield on the mic cord, and yeah, they're very troublesome at times, but that's what it is. Okay, back to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, so I can say, with the power supply, again, I don't know, is there anyone producing, the question was, is there somebody producing a power supply that uses a conventional power transformer, I can say the path transit, I wonder if there's such a thing still on the market, or is it all switching power supplies now? I know QST reviews power supplies. They've done that a number of times, and I didn't see any reference to a power supply that uses the old conventional power transformer. I have a feeling possibly is that gone with the wind, or do you think it's still available to take over?
I have in front of me an Astron power supply, RS-35M. It's a 35 ampere power supply with a 0 to 40, I guess that's ampere meter on the left, and 0 to 15 voltmeter on the right. As it doesn't say volts and doesn't say amps, you're supposed to know. I'm pretty sure it contains the power supply. I think it's still available. Does anybody know if the Astron power supplies, the old-fashioned transformer type, are still available?
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
The Astron makes two different lines of power supplies. They make a whole bunch of lines, they generally differentiate switchers from the linear power supply by the prefix on the part number. There was like one's called like an R and the other one's called an SS. All the ones I think that have SS in front of them are the switchers. All the other prefixes are the I think it's like RM is the standard linear power supply. KC2QIQ, back over to you, Jeff.
It sounds to me like they're still available. I'll bet you if I looked in the back of QST magazine, I'd find Astron power supplies still available. So I think you can still get non-switchers, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, it says K2KEY. Well, like I say, if it's going to sit in a ham shack in one spot on a shelf, the few extra pounds are not going to make much of a difference. Double, triple weight. You don't have to tote it around. So I guess for those purists that really want something extremely quiet, I guess you can't beat the old-fashioned method of taking, the power transformer, dropping the voltage initially from the 110 volts down to the low voltage and processing it from there. I would assume that's basically I'm still a viable way to go, Dick. Go ahead.
M2EO, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
I use an Astron RS-50M. The M is metered. It's metered to current and voltage. 50 amps with a transformer, linear supply. 50 amps intermittent, 35 amps, 37 amps. I don't want to take that number. Continuous 13.8.
Now I know what my model number says, RS-35M, M meaning metered, 35 amps intermittent, and mine is probably something like 29 amps continuous. Sound approximately right there, Rich?
Got it, Dick. They go up to 70 amps, the Astron. I didn't feel I needed anything like that, but I bought the RS-50M because I had owned a 20 amp and needed something a little more, so I skipped by and went to the RS-50. But they got yours, 35, 50, and the RS-70.
Do you happen to know the approximate price range of any of those supplies, Rich, today?
The RS-50 that I own, I don't remember the exact price. Somewhere around $250. I know it's a little over 200. I think 250 thereabouts.
Without the meters, they're cheaper.
Correct. By the way, I've owned a number of Astron supplies. They got little pots on the back of the meters to calibrate them. I have not had one that's been calibrated properly. You have to go in there and do it yourself.
Are there other pots in the power supply where you can set the output voltage if you want to, Rich?
There is, Dick. On the regulator board, there's this pot. I always set it a little bit on the high side for the drop in the cable. I normally keep mine set around 14.1. And with cables on the radio, when they draw current, they come out like around, I think, 13.9, 13.85.
Are there enough connectors on the front on the back panel that would allow you to do remote sensing? If you're willing to put two more wires out there, you could make the voltage appear at whatever you want on the far side. Go ahead.
You could do that. You would have to bring a line out, but he's going to do that on the supply to their SD-104 transceiver. The problem is if the line gets severed, the voltage is going to soar up.
You got to put 10 ohm resistors in there as a backup.
Yeah, and the voltage soaring up would not be too much of a problem if you put a Cobra circuit in there, an overvoltage protection circuit. So there are ways around that. Anyone with any comments on all this?
KC2QAQ.
10 ohm resistors. A crowbar is a rather brutal safety feature.
Okay, on a quick break, Ed, how would you use a 10 ohm resistor to protect you from overvoltage at the far end?
You tie ohms from the output to the remote sensor. So if the remote sensor overvoltage, you keep it from running a bump.
You see what he's saying, Dick. In other words, if the remote sensor goes bad, the 10 ohm resistor will keep it from going totally bananas. That makes a lot of sense, Ed.
I like that. Now I understand it. And as long as your 10 ohm resistor is high compared to the very low number of ohms of your auxiliary wiring that's doing the remote sensing, then you'll always get the right answer. I like that. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And most of the times, on most supplies I know that have external sensing leads, that's usually internal to the power supplies there. Either that or also you can use two diode drops. You can put two diode drops from the sense lead back to from the power lead to the sense lead. And this way if the sense lead goes up, it can only go up by two diode drops, which is, I usually find it works a little bit better than the, it doesn't mess with the regulation, because normally the 10 ohm resistor will give you an offset. You know, it's just kind of like being a little particular about it, where when the diode's there, it's, and it's in regulation, the sense lead, it's outside of the regulation, so it doesn't cause an offset or an error in the feedback. One other warning I was just going to point out about running external sense leads, especially with RF circuitry, is that keep in mind that it isn't a feedback part of an amplifier. So anything that gets picked up on those sense leads is going to drive your, you know, the voltage back into your transceiver. It could drive it crazy. So you kind of have to be careful, like twist the leads very, very carefully, nice and tight, and if you can, tie wrap them to the power leads going directly out to the source so that they don't pick up anything straight and will upset the output voltage. Back to you there, KP2QIQ.
WP2HWW.
Howie recognized, and I can see what you're saying. Your external sense lead can easily become an antenna if it picks up enough RF energy and shoves that back into the remote sensing of the power supply. It can be rectified in the first stage of amplification, shift the bias level, and therefore essentially create a brand new reference voltage, which can drive the voltage high or low depending on what's going on. So you got to be rather careful with that. I would use a combination of twisted leads, braided shields, bypass capacitors at the remote sense of the power supply, and so on, to make sure that you don't have RF sensitivity. There's a fair number of regulated power supplies that are feeding brick amplifiers that have run into problems where the RF voltage picking up did some pretty crazy things. Go ahead, Howie, H-U-R-I-W on the TechNet.
All right, Dick, I'm going to back off the mic. Hope this is okay. I run an Astron supply at one of my sites. Have an RM60. I've done three things to the supply. One, we soldered, make sure all the transistors were soldered. We put fans on every side of the box. We drilled holes and we put fans in. Number three, as far as over voltage protection, I use transorbs. I get like a 15 volt or a 15 or like a PK60B, which is a transorb, and I put them across all my equipment. So anywhere in the equipment, if anything sees a higher than, let's say, 14.8 or 15, the transorb will short, and this, and the supply is a, you know, crowbar protection. And I never remotely censor just because you could have RF. But I definitely add a transorb across the supply, so in case the supply goes up. Another comment, Dick, as far as spirit resonant power supplies, I have one on our 10-meter transmitter. We have a GE Orion, we have a GE transor, a GE spirit resonant linear supply for the 13 volt, and that gets super hot. I've never seen so much heat. I've never seen so much heat. So spirit resonants are nice, but they have one drawback. They generate a lot of heat. K2RAW, WD2HWW. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm guessing the heat is generated by the actual regulation process, which is a kind of magnetic saturation of a core, controlled saturation. And I can see how that could be a little bit power wasteful. But it's not, as long as you're not running off of batteries or off of solar cells, that may not be too serious, and it may give you more than you lose, so to speak. I like remote sensing, and I like Glenn's idea of using the double diode drop. That way you're not hurting the regulation. You're getting perfect regulation, if and only if, to make sure that your diodes are not becoming an RF rectifier. I'm thinking right now, the direction in which you would set the diodes such that the voltage output is allowed to be higher, so therefore the diodes look like they're being forward biased by the main supply line going back to the remote sense lead on the back of the power supply. Therefore, if any RF rectification took place, it would be driving the remote sense in the positive manner. Yes, it would be driving it positive, and therefore the remote sense RF pickup would false alarm the remote sense circuitry inside the power supply into thinking that the voltage remotely being measured was too high. So it would decrease the output voltage. That's not so serious. It's not a complete showstopper, so to speak. Although it certainly could cause all kinds of crazy motorboating. K2KEY, K2RAW on the tech net.
K2QIQ with one more comment.
Go ahead, Mel. Glenn.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the safest and best regulation clamps, you know, in case something fails in the sensors. As a matter of fact, the only other one condition that's sometimes also a good thing to do is put a fuse in series with the sensor line in case the sensor line ever gets shorted. And the reason there is because if they get shorted, the voltage shoots. Basically, the output will go into full high, and the only thing that will protect it there is over voltage within the power supply. Another quick comment about the magnetic resonance transformers. It's really strictly depends on the designer and how they want to design the peak flux capability of the transformer and how much cross-sectional area you allow for the transformer. If you build with a high enough peak flux capability in the transformer and you use enough cross-sectional area, you can keep the temperature so there's virtually no visible temperature rise in a ferroresonance type of transformer. But I guess because of cost concerns and other things, people tend to cheap out in certain parts of the power supply. Back to you, there, KB2QIQ.
WB2HWW, a couple more comments, please.
Yeah, how we recognized. Glenn, most of the ferroresonant power conditioner transformers I've used have a oil-filled capacitor as part of that network connected to the transformer. Any idea what that transformer is doing? What that capacitor is doing?
Yes, that's the steering capacitor, and it actually has to work with the peak voltage flux of the transformer. So in other words, like you said, the transformer goes into saturation, and basically the capacitor stores the energy during that period of time, thus creating like a semi-saturated condition, so that the energy stored between the capacitor and the primary winding with its magnetization current, the currents that don't conduct through the transformer. So basically you have a conductive current that's determined by the load that's drawing the average current through the transformer. And if you have a certain amount of lower inductance in the primary winding, that always has a circulation current that never passes through the secondary, and it's being circulated between that capacitor and the primary winding. And that basically is what creates the voltage shift between the capacitor and the primary winding, so it looks almost like a pre-regulation. Back to you, Jeff.
Would you say that that portion of the circuit with the capacitor is almost a leakage, a controlled leakage reactant?
No, because leakage usually means something different. Leakage inductance is usually something that determines coupling. How well does something couple from primary to secondary? And that's usually determined on how well the windings are attached to each other magnetically. Magnetization current is different. That determines what's your primary inductance. So if your primary inductance is low, the transformer could still have very, very good coupling from primary to secondary, meaning that the leakage is low. But basically what's happening is that you have that primary circulating current, low inductance of the primary.
That sounds like an art and science of itself, for properly doing that kind of a design. Go ahead, Howie. H-U-R-I-W in the tech manual.
Dick, two comments. Comment number one, with Ferret Resident supplies, you got to keep your audio equipment or any audio cables way far away. Those things tend to put out very strong magnetic fields. That's the first thing. I wound it up when we put our 10-meter system up. We had a hum, and we couldn't... the electronic equipment... Well, I hope you captured me okay. If you're not, I'll make a change here. But second, as far as the Airtron supplies, Dick, I always run the supplies as highest voltage as I can. I turn the voltage up because the higher the voltage on the output, the less power dissipation you're going to dissipate across the transistors. So I try to run it around 14 and a quarter to 14 and a half just so I keep down the power dissipation and the regulating transistors don't get as hot. Over to you.
Yep, I can see what you're doing there. You got to be careful, though. You don't run into the bottoming and mount problem. It's just that the voltage higher than the instantaneous minimum voltage coming out of the rectifier network. But you know about that. Your audio is extremely high, Howie. You've got to cut that back 8-10 dB. Once in a while, your words will jump out of the repeater, so to speak. I think we're ready for probably the next... the next mailbag letter, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2AWW, Dick, did you copy what I said?
Yes, we did. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, one final word, K2KEY. The power supply, the old one that I'm using, I guess say that I basically bought the parts at that time. And used it many, many moons ago. In fact, it was the last the Apollo flight that I was there for. The overvoltage protection in it, Dick, he uses a relay. He's got a relay in there which is connected to an FCR and a Zener diode. And that's the overvoltage protection, and then he's got another little circuit in there, the undervoltage protection, that's the short protection. But it all goes and controls a regular old-fashioned mechanical relay, and he's got a button you put in the back for testing it. And once it latches, it stays that way, you know, until you flip the power switch off and reset it. So that's the method that the protection method, the voltage goes over 15 volts. It trips the relay over, you know, and opens it. Or if, I should say the contacts are normally open, you know, that the two parallel contacts, two 15 or 20 amp contact relays, contacts in there, so you trip that relay, Zach, and it lights up on a panel fork. That's the way it was done in those days, Dick, over.
Does sound like a pretty safe technique without dissipating a whole lot of power. A crowbar circuit, although it gives you a fair amount of protection of your circuitry downrange, it can be pretty tough on a power supply, unless the power supply has current fallback regulation built into it. And not too many of them do. All of those regulators that are in the Hewlett-Packard signal generator do have fallback regulators that go into a self-protect mode, and they automatically restore themselves when the short circuit's removed. Back to you, Mel.
It was a nice little circuit. In fact, I think they published it a couple of places, different magazines, to add to your power supply if you wanted a fail-safe method of instantly disconnecting the power source, because, like I say, it's all self-contained with the relay and everything, and if you have a situation developing where the voltage goes up over, that's the most thing you worry about, of course, is the voltage going up over, you know, to God knows how high it'll go. Something goes wacky in this, the power supply, that the overvoltage protection will fire the relay, which is a very positive way of doing it, I would assume. All right, shall we go on?
Dick, our power supply, the Astron, have fallback protection as well as cobalt.
Very nice. Yeah, Mel, go ahead on.
Shall we read on? All right, here, I'm a new ham. Just getting into ham radio, and I'd like to put up some antennas this summer. I've got my license now to be able to operate HF bands, and I'd love to get on if I could put up some dipoles. They tell me that I should buy at the club. I should make sure I get the right kind of wire, not to use regular wire. That the ideal wire to use is, he meant copper clad wire, the way we all wrote it. Copper cloud wire. It's not copper clad wire. Okay, I tried making it out of this way. And also, the rope I use must be of a special kind of rope, which I'm not sure I understand. They call this, Dacron? Yeah, oh, okay. Not Dacron, spelled it wrong. It's Dacron, not Dacron. Dacron wire, Dacron cord, or rope. Am I correct in these assumptions, Dick, over?
I've built lots of dipole antennas out of 14-gauge household copper wire, and they work like a charm. Got to create a little bit of care on the center conductor. There's the insulator in the center. Try to give it a little bit of strain relief to make sure that as the antenna waves in the breeze, depending on how you support it, you're not going to be creating any continuous bending back and forth of the copper in that area, which could give you some metal fatigue and eventually failure. There are some people who just love copper-clad steel wire. Because of the skin effect, the copper, there's a thin layer of copper on top. The RF only sees the copper. It never gets down to the steel, which has got much higher resistivity. I'm not a big fan of copper-clad steel. I just use ordinary copper household wire, and almost always that's stripped off in insulation. I think you don't really have to. The rope that you hang the dipole with, if you're a guy who wants to have longevity of his antenna, let me drop. It should be some kind of ultraviolet protected rope. When you go to your marine supply store or a good hardware store, or if you go to, I can't think of the name of the store, but in Huntington, on Jericho Turnpike, on the western end of Huntington, on the north side of the street, is a surplus dealer of marine products. You walk in there and he's got 40 different kinds of rope. And if you buy the kinds of rope that are black in color, almost always those are the ones that are ultraviolet protected, whether it be polypropylene or nylon or Dacron or whatever. If it's black in color, usually the blackness in color is to give it ultraviolet protection. Ordinary Dacron rope, for instance, in the sun will turn into powder in about 1.5 years. White nylon rope in the sun will turn into powder in about 4 years. Ultraviolet protected black rope, Dacron or whatever, will last probably 10 or more years. Now the rope that you'd like to suspend the dipole onto something else with rope. It's a lot easier to do than with wire. It's safer, easier, and so on. But if you really wanted super longevity, the extended leads after the egg insulators at the end of the dipole, they could be wire. And that could be steel wire if you wanted to. But I like rope better. A nice way to string a dipole up in the air is to shoot some string over the tree with a bow and arrow or with a slingshot monofilament line, which pulls up some cord, some twine, which pulls up the actual rope. And there's various ways. You got to worry to do that. You got to worry about the fact that the tree is going to move in the wind. So whether you put on springs or pulleys and weights or whatever, you have to accommodate the tree is going to move on a windy day. And if the two ends of your dipole are being suspended by two separate trees, Mother Nature dictates that those trees are going to move in opposite directions. So you've got to put enough springiness in the system to accommodate that. It's kind of hard to go wrong with a dipole. It's the most basic of antennas, extremely high in performance, not very high in cost. And if at worst it fails, replacing it is not a big, it's not going to cause a fortune. So these are some of my opinions. I like the center insulator to be a balloning device. In other words, if the coax cable goes into the bottom, goes into an SO239 connector that's on your coaxial ballon, Unideller and a few other brand names make these things that work on 80 to 10 meters. They make sure that there is no RF current flowing on the outside of the coax cable.
You don't. Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You don't have to do it that way. You can make a poor man's ballon by a few turns of your coax cable held together with black tape right at the center of the dipole or a couple of feet below it, acting as an RF choke. That's what the balloning device really does do. It's a kind of an RF choke. Just that it's a nice package which gives you the mechanical support and nice rings where you can connect the dipole wires themselves. I string the wires through those eyes, wrap it back on itself about 3 or 4 turns. Sometimes I solder it, sometimes I don't. And the same thing on the egg insulators at the far end. You might not want to do the permanent wrapping of the wire at the far end of your egg insulators, because you might want to add or subtract a little bit of length from the dipole in order to center its frequency on your favorite frequency. If you do a standing wave ratio plot and you get that bathtub curve, but the bottom of the bathtub is at 4 megacycles instead of 3.7, then you know your dipole is a little bit short. You've got to add some copper to it. And adding that extra copper is rather easy. It can even be done in the form of a clip lead or a piece of wire that hangs straight down, so to speak. There's nothing magic about the dipole being all out straight in one single piece. It can zigzag in all kinds of ways, and it'll give you 98% of the exact same performance. If in order to bring your dipole down in frequency, you have to add 3 feet of wire to each end, and you simply wrap it through that output egg insulator, the outboard egg insulator, and connect it to the remaining wire that's there, that's the real dipole, and then your extra 3 feet, you hang it straight down instead of straight out, it doesn't matter. It'll work like a charm. Stop worrying. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2EAV with one or two quick comments.
Go ahead, Ed.
Item one, if you're talking about the surplus star about a mile and a half west of Route 110 on Jericho with the cedar shake shingles, they seem to be out of business. QSL?
Wow. Boise is out of business after all of these years. Wow. How recent is that information, Ed?
At least between six months and a year, I'd say.
For all the years I've lived in Huntington, that was an institution. Very unhappy that they finally failed. Any idea where a substitute location might be?
My guess is he packed it up and moved to Florida or something. I really don't know. There's no sign or anything. It looks just the way it did, but it's always dark whenever I go past it. It's possible they're open Tuesdays to Thursdays from 12 to 4, but, you know, I would doubt it. Second item, balance. I had an old ballon I recently tried to resurrect for a 40-meter dipole, and it was better than the doornail. And then I started looking into replacing it, and I was looking at stuff on the internet, and I find a lot of comments. Apparently, those ballons have a fairly high failure rate. There seem to be some non-ballon diode center insulator doohickeys, one of which I bought at the last Limark flea market, and I'm very happy with. That seem to be, you know, mechanically quite rugged, weatherproof, and all that stuff. And like you said, a couple of turns of the coax might be, you know, with one of those might be better than a ballon. Also, it's $10 versus $30.
So we owe this.
Go ahead, Rich. Thank you, Ed. Go ahead, Rich.
Dick, on the black Jack Barn rope, as of a couple of years ago, I'm sure they still have it, ham radio outlet stock that black Jack Barn rope. They have it three different size, you know, gauges, sizes, whatever. Also, for this fellow who wrote in, a lot of people think that you have to take the insulation off and use bare wire for a dipole. Doesn't matter. The RF doesn't know the difference. Also, instead of using a ballon and coax, I think you know what I like, Dick. Consider a half wavelength dipole. It's the lowest frequency you're going to use. It's heated with open wire line, and the tuna works great on all bands.
Don, good suggestion. One step better than that, in my opinion, would be a fan dipole. A dipole where 80, 40, 20, and 10 maybe, individual dipoles are all connected to the same semiconductor in the center and all fanned out a little bit from each other. And there's various versions with choke assemblies, inductor capacitor assemblies along the length of a wire to make it a multi-band dipole. So there's a number of ways of making a multi-band dipole. The one that Rich just gave to us and the other two techniques, fanning and putting LC networks into it. The ARRL antenna handbook will give you lots of information along these lines. Anybody have any further comments on this one? KQRIW in the TechNet.
Don't forget, a 40-meter dipole gives you 15 as a freebie.
Good point, and I like it. Therefore, that's part of, I guess, what I was thinking when I said 80, 40, 20, 10. You don't really have to put in the 15. And if you've got an antenna tuner, my guess is the 17 sort of comes almost automatically, too. Is that true, Ed?
Never tried it, but it sounds good.
Yeah, as long as you've got a low enough feed line insertion loss, an open wire line does that very nicely. And as long as you've got an antenna tuner with enough range to it, you can make any old hunk of wire resonate at your frequency. And you must resonate before you will radiate with any reasonable efficiency. And once you hit resonance, because you've got enough tuning range in your antenna tuner, you're essentially home free. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. It's funny that the 40-meter dipole, that local one I have, I don't know if it actually can call it, it's a very steep slope. It goes from the 66-foot support point down to the ground at all around 28-degree angle. And you know, I haven't got no balun in there because when I put it together, I had one day. I picked up at one of the ham fests this old gadget that they would sell it, a bunch of screws that had around it that puts in half, and the inside you soldered a coax to the two hooks that protrude through the edge of the cage, and then you put the screws all back, must be about a dozen of them, and it clamps the coax, it clamps everything up, and then you hang your dipole on the outside of it, and it got two other spots where you soldered, the wires to on the hook that support it, and that's what I'm using as a center insulator on the dipole. It seems to work quite well. I only use it on the CW portion of the plate. I have no complaints how it works, to tell you the truth, that Dick. And let me let it drop.
I want to good evening. I want to say something. So you can see the house.
And how?
When you're done, Mel, I'll pick it up.
Okay, nice. With you, I guess, you know, Steve. If it's important, Andy, go ahead.
No, it's just not antennas. I saw something today which might be intriguing, but I'll talk to you about it.
Hey, Andy, very good. Anyhow, now as far as the rope goes, Dick, when I put up the two poles in the backyard here, the two supports went up on a Sunday. What do you think the one thing I forgot was rope? And I said, oh my God, these things are going to be put in place now. I have no rope. How did I forget that? You know, everything I thought, holy shit, why didn't I think of rope? So I ran over to a local hardware store here, Lucky. That's one guy I know who was open. And the only thing he had was clothesline. So I bought a couple hanks of clothesline, you know, I don't know how many feet it is, I guess it was about 100 feet, 150 feet or 45 feet or whatever it was at the time. And I think about it, that's what's on those poles that pull up the loop. And I'm saying to myself, that should be replaced, but how do I do that trick, over?
Is there a way that you found to do it?
I don't know. The only thing I could think of is use one of those, you know that Chinese, what do they call that trick where you put your two fingers, you remember as a kid that old thing that the Chinese, called the Chinese finger trick, where you gave it to somebody and they push their finger in on each end of it, and they put, and when they try to pull their fingers out, it don't come. We also use that called a loop. We used to pull cables with a thing like that. It was called a loom, and used to force it onto the cable. About a few feet long, you force it onto the cable, and you take the end of it, and then on the other end was a hook, and the rope went on there and pulled. We used to pull the cable like that through the conduit. I think maybe something like that, Dick, over.
What I have done in the past is to open up the lay of the three leads of a rope on both ends, put them together carefully and tape it. I've actually spliced the end of a rope together, two different kinds of rope. Although with clothesline, you can't easily do that. Depending on the size of the pulleys, you may be able to tape it together just right. You can't tie a knot and have it go through the pulleys. It'll jam, of course. Andy, what would you like to add to all this? And you might need a little bit more audio, Andy.
Yeah, I can bring up the gain a bit. It might be on there. Oh, yeah, good evening. I just got home and I'm really tired. I was at a party tonight. I gotta get ready to go to work tomorrow. I just want to mention, Dick, I saw something today. You might be interested in hearing about an antenna. Actually, Mel is probably familiar with this one. And it goes way back. So, back in the 60s, there was a company, the company still exists, they make the Hustler brand of antennas, and the company's called Neutronics. You've probably heard of them, they've been very popular, and I have a bunch of their resonators, and a lot of people do, and so on. They actually made made, and you probably know this, or maybe you don't, a motorized dipole. And I happen to have seen one today. Actually, the guy's got it for sale. And it's a telescopic dipole, sort of like the step of beam configuration, where there's a motor at the end. It's interesting because there's actually two motors. By putting two motors back to back and connecting them together, each motor extends the telescopic sections outward in each direction, I guess together. And the antenna is called the cliff dweller, which is not related to the cliff dweller antenna that's on the market now. Going back to the 60s, Mel, I'm just curious. I got a feeling you're familiar with this antenna because it was popular back then. Dick, just back to you for that.
They had that antenna in the 64-65 World Fair, Andy. It's 40-meter dipole, rotatable dipole. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, yeah, what it uses, if you remember, the automobile antennas that had the electric automobile antenna, that how they used to have that plastic rod, and it goes through the tubing and roll up on a reel and push the antenna up and down. And, you remember those antennas that the unit, you know, the whole roll and everything sat in the trunk of the car. Or you have the, they have them on the front of the car, side sender also. The nice part was that it was great because this way the little brats, and I use that word very liberally with some of them, what they really are, didn't break the antennas off, because they used to break the antennas off the cars and make zip trucks with them. That thing would pull the rod down when you shut the radio off in the car or the power went off, you know, in the car you shut the key off. It pulled the antenna rod right straight down, you know, flush with the bottom of the fender or in the back, you know, into the trunk unit. That's how they worked, Dick, over.
Very nice. So I think you're saying they had one of those at the World's Fair. And I guess that's something that Rich probably used, because I think he was involved in that operation. Or maybe Mel was, too. Stepper has got a pretty nice technique for adjusting an antenna. I think they've got a rotatable dipole, as well as their 40-meter and also the 20-meter through 6-meter three-element Yagi. And there's a guy in the Midwest who has put up six of those. What a great big array on 180-foot of Rhone number 65 tower. K9 LTN, I think it's Lima Tango November. You Google those call letters, and you'll see a series of pictures of an antenna under construction last Christmas, a year and a third ago. What a significant antenna. Back to you, Mel.
I don't believe it was ever completed either. The last time I heard about it, ran into some kind of difficulty. Anyhow, that was the first of the type of stepper. It was a rotatable dipole. Now, also, there was a kit or something, or somebody came up that you could turn it into a beam by putting two of them on a boom setup. And that's basically how it works. That's why they had two motors, because to drive, you know, dipole, each side was individually driven. And it covered, I think, 20 and 40 meters at the time. Well, we didn't have anything between, no, 30 meters or anything like that. And, I remember, made by Neutronics, Dick. Very interesting, very simple. I guess, in fact, maybe that's where Stepper got the idea, except they replaced that with using PVC pipe. Wasn't, of course, available then. And some tape measures in there, actually, copper tape measures, Dick, over.
That antenna in 1965 was $149.95. You could buy it at Harrison's.
Nice device. I forgot to hand it back to you, Andy. Where were you when you saw this antenna today, Andy?
Okay, well, just a little background here. This guy that I know has three of them that he wants to sell. And he showed me one because I wanted to see them. I didn't quite understand what he was explaining to me, the type of antenna, until I actually saw it, then I knew what it was, because I've seen it. I even have a catalog with this antenna listed in it. And which is right, it's about 100 change when it was out. Interestingly enough, this antenna is specifically designed for the 40 and 80 meter band. And think about it. A tubular antenna, a tubular dipole on 80 meters is quite long. And I said to myself, that's what really supports it? If it's going to be just held by a mast, what's going to stop the very end from drooping down? It's so long. I said to myself, it must be a short dipole. It has to be. And sure enough, it is. It's got a nice coil, just like the Neutronics, you know, resonating coils that you've seen that you put on the cars. It's got the same coil configuration with a rubberized jacket over the coil, so you can see the windings underneath on each side of the dipole. And the total length, according to the specifications, is about 40 feet rather than 60 feet. So it's about 20 feet shorter on each side, given that it has a coil as part of the configuration. And that's on, of course, 80 meters. Still, 40 feet is quite a good size. The thing that that disturbs me is that he's got two used ones. One used one and two that are brand new, never been used, still in their wrappings. One was in the original tube, the cylinder tube, the cardboard tube that it comes in. However, turns out that it's been outside for the past number of years, not sure how many, and the moisture got into the tube and the tube started to unroll. You know, the cardboard got damp and softened up, and inside where the motor is, it was all oxidized from the weather and the moisture and everything else, because it's been laying around for the past 20 years or more. So it needs a good cleaning.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I won't time it out. it's a new condition. It's new, but it needs work, only because it's corroded. So I'm debating whether to take one and fix it up and try it out, play with it, see how it works out. The other one that's also new is out of its tube. It looks like it's got some also corrosion. I didn't take the wrapping around the motor side of it, but the center portion looks like there's some corrosion. Quite a bit of rust, given that it's just been laying around. Interesting, because it's an old antenna, but it's never been installed. Back to you, Dick, just thought I'd mention it. So I'm debating, I may pick one up, or maybe I pick two of them up, because they're not asking for much.
The one thing that's not clear, Andy, is that you said it's 40 feet long. Does that mean 40 feet to the right and 40 feet to the left, or 40 feet total? Go ahead.
Dick, it's 40-meter band, 40 feet long, not 80 feet. 40 meters.
I thought Andy said there was an 80 meter version. Over to you, Andy.
Yeah, this antenna is for 75 and 40 meters. It's a dual. It'll extend out to 75 meters. But that length. I don't know what that actual length is, because I didn't see that spec.
Okay, when you said 40 feet, is that total tip to tip, or is it 40 feet out from center when it's on 75 meters?
No, it's, I believe, total tip to tip.
Okay, so a 75-meter antenna that wants to be 132 feet long is 40 feet long, total, tip to tip. That is a little bit less than one-third the length. So, my guess is if you tuned it for 3,700, you can't go much more than 100 kc up or down before you got to retune it.
Yeah, of course I didn't play with it to see what the bandwidth of it is, but given that it's a tubular antenna, it has to be short because there's no support for it, so that would make sense.
When you use the motor on the antenna, are you using it to collapse it to get it out of an ice storm and a wind storm, or are you doing it to adjust the length to peak it up at your favorite frequency?
As far as I know, you peak it up to for the frequency you're going to use it on. I didn't read the instructions that closely because it's quite extensive. And since I haven't played with this antenna, I'm not sure. Maybe Rick has more information if he used it. But it is designed for those two bands. Bandwidth, I'm not sure.
And how the control box with a knob up and down, you would just simply go for resonance pick, minimum SWR, the frequency you're going to operate. Maybe Mel has some more information, Dick.
You got it, Mel. And you can either discuss this or the next one, but we've only got 3 minutes. Over to you, Mel.
Well, there were several versions of it. And the version that Rich is talking about, yeah, had an up-down control effect. You know, somewhere it's possible. I'm just going to say it was possible. One came down in a storm, and my friend abandoned it at that time. It was twisted. And he said, you want to take it? And I said, no, I don't want it at all. And then he was beating up. Well, I'm throwing this out. And it was a box. And on the box was an SWR box, and it had a control on it, up-down lever that stood in the middle. You know, spring returned to the middle, and that's what you adjusted it. The antenna rod, you know, how in and out was this thing. You watched that meter with the box. I think I still have that box. It's a nice little meter in it. I think that's what Richard is referring to, Dick, over.
Was it a black with a sloping front?
Ah, I remember. It was a sloping front, black sloping front. It had an indicator lamp on it. I don't remember. That's funny, I don't remember that. I have a feeling it may be in my junk pile somewhere because I know I took the box from it. I couldn't let it go out that night.
Sounds like Rich has no further comments on this one. Okay, we've got about 2 minutes left. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1182 of the series, 1182 of the series that began in September of 1982. Assuming that Mel and I and the rest of you guys stay healthy, we'll be back next week and we'll figure out more of these things about antennas. We're going to get this all straightened out one of these days. 73, you all, be kind to each other. And back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
B2HWW with a
mattress
for Dick.
Okay, let Mel sign out first, and then we'll go over to Howie. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, real quickly, thank you all for joining us, and like Dick said, we'll try to do it again next week, and I'll try to answer some of the emails that we don't get to, and we'll try to, like I say, we'll give you the best answer I can. As long as you keep it again in the realm of amateur radio and associated things. Please, I'm getting deluged by a lot of other extracurricular things that I can't answer, so don't get offended if I don't answer because it's just not in my, not in the category of amateur radio. Go ahead, Holly.
Give me no advice to the lovelorn.
WB2HWW. Dick, I got an email tonight from Professor Joel Levitt. Who says you're doing a great job and a great service to the public. And he is still a pleasant professor at Pratt
because I'm streaming this on the internet, he was listening to the TechNet, and he said, you and Mel are providing a great service.
Glad to hear that, Howie. I don't remember if I've ever met Professor Lem. I don't think so. He may have come after I graduated in 1964. Over to you, Howie.
He came in 65. He was there in 65. He got hired, I think, by North. Do you remember Dr. North?
Don't recognize that name. Wonder what year he arrived. Heron Marus was the head of the electrical engineering department in my year. Can't think of a man who headed the engineering entirely. The head of the chemistry department was the head of all of engineering. Howard Boyette was one of our chief electrical engineering professors. I'm trying to think of some of the other names. Over to you, Howie.
Oh, Krinsky. Remember Krinsky? K-R-I-N-S-K-Y. He taught chemistry. I think he was also the dean at the time.
I'm not sure that was the dean of the chemistry department at the time. Guy with red hair, white face, can't think of his name right now. I'll have to go back to my yearbook.
All right, Krinsky was in a wheelchair. I don't know if he was in a wheelchair at that time. He was still teaching well into the 80s. I had him. And you do remember Professor Helm.
Helm, absolutely. We all took freshman calculus with Helm.
Yeah, he was a cool guy. Yeah, I remember a lot of stories about him. All right, so I just want to let you know, I'm streaming it. Actually, if anybody wants to know, they can listen. If I have a chance, I bring the net up, and I stream it over the internet at my website at hww.com. So we are streaming it, and we've been doing that for the last couple of 50 days have been on IRLC.
And I should mention that anyone who wants to listen to the past TechNet,
12 a.m. 7
anyone who wants to listen to the past TechNet for the last almost year, you can go to www.amateurradio.tv, amateurradio.tv, and you can listen to all the past TechNets. They're also classified by. Okay, amateurradio.tv, and there you'll find all of the past TechNets, all documented as to what subject is discussed every 5 minutes of every 4-hour TechNet for the last year. An amazing amount of work that's been done. Bye-bye, you all.
Okay, I'm just keeping it on for you, Dick. Dick, by the way, we made a vote. We're going to keep the repeater on. It's no longer going to be going off at 12 o'clock. It's going to stay on all night. Just for a comment. Go ahead.
I hear you. But Mel and I are still going to quit at midnight.
Yes.
Enough is enough.